Congratulations, you. You're listening to a Radio 191 FM podcast. Yes, you are.
You're tuned in to the R1 News, your stop for news and current affairs on the airwaves. 11 to 12 weekdays here on Radio 191 FM. Te reo irirangi kotahi.
Tēnā koutou I tēnei ata. Kei te whakarunga mai koe ki te reo irirangi kotahi.
Ko Kaia toku ingoa.
Ko Zach toku ingoa. And you're listening to the R1 News Show for Rapa, te tikau o here turi koka on Radio 1 te reo irirangi kotahi.
On the program, e tēnei rā, we have an exclusive USC snow report live from the chairlift at Cadrona Alpine Resort.
Very exciting. Following that, I will be chatting with Professor Peter McIntyre from the University of Otago's Department of Women's and Children's Health about the polio outbreak in New York.
Then I am exploring the environmental impacts of the Leith's flooding event and other flooding events around Aotearoa with Professor Chris Hepburn before speaking to Associate Research Professor Gabrielle Davey about the recent proposed restructuring of Aotearoa's government data collection bill and what this change could mean for the way we collect data.
Lastly, we'll be putting the pedal to the metal for Leos and Pisces in this week's astrology report. Firstly, though, we have news and weather updates. But before that, we gotta play a tune. This is Hardly Unclear with Strangers. You're listening to the R1 News on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. Puritia kia raka.
When I got up out of bed this morning, I didn't know you yet. And I still don't know you now. But at least I know I want to if we never meet again. Press all the buttons to extend the time we spend together here in constant undulation, distracted we ascend at an unfamiliar head, heart to heart and now kiss in muted celebration. Two steps, 10 floors.
Kia ora koutou katoa, you're listening to the Rapa R1 News here on Radio 1, Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. That was Strangers from Harvey Unclear. It is currently 11:07 a.m. and right now we have the news and with updates from Eileen.
The R1 News Headlines.
Tēnā koutou, ko Eileen aho. National Party MP Sam Ufendahl has been stood down from the party as an investigation into allegations of bullying and violence begins. Yesterday, it was revealed Ufendahl, aged 16 at the time, was asked to leave prestigious private school King's College in Auckland after he and three other students brutally attacked a 13-year-old student, allegedly with wooden bed legs. Ufendahl has issued an apology to the victim just months before he stood for election in Tauranga, 22 years after the incident. Late last night, a further allegation against Ufendahl was made by a woman who flattered with him during his time at the University of Otago. Speaking to RNZ's Morning Report, the woman said Ufendahl was an aggressive bully, and in a drunken outburst where he banged on her bedroom door and yelled at her resulted in her escaping out the bedroom window and moving out of the flat. Just after 11 p.m. last night, National Party leader Christopher Luxon said Ufendahl would be stood down whilst an independent investigation is carried out. Ufendahl disputes the claim made by his former flatmate. The Firearms Prohibition Order legislation bill has passed its third reading in Parliament unanimously. The bill would empower courts to ban those convicted of certain crimes, including murder and domestic violence, from accessing firearms. A firearms prohibition order could be put in place for up to 10 years. The government says it will reduce gun-related crime by targeting those who are most likely to illegally use firearms. National and ACT could form the next government as the Labor government's popularity dips, according to the latest One News Kantar poll. Despite Jacinda Ardern returning her lowest preferred Prime Minister score since her election in 2017, she is still ahead of National Party leader Christopher Luxon, scoring 32% to his 30%. 37% indicated they would vote for National, whilst 33% support Labor. Sitting on 11%, Libertarian Right ACT Party could form a government with National. The Greens sit on 9%, whilst Te Pāti Māori are at 2%, meaning even if Labour allied with both of these potential coalition partners, it still would not beat National. General elections are still more than a year away. And those were the headlines on R1 News. Now, ke te pēhea te āhua o te rangi. How's the weather?
The R1 News weather.
I tēnei rā, morning frost should be clearing to fine, though nippy, afternoon. A high of Waru, 8, and a low of Whā, 4, is accompanied by southwesterlies developing through the afternoon, with showers at night. Rāpare, Thursday, should see partial morning cloud clear to a fine afternoon, with light winds, a high of Whitu/7, and a low of Tahi, 1.
That was the R1 News headlines. Catch up at r1.co.nz/news or find us at Radio 1 91 FM on Twitter or R1 News NZ on Instagram and tune in to R1 News at 11 a.m. on weekdays.
Kia ora Eileen for those excellent news and weather updates. It's currently 11:10 here on the Rapa R1 News program. Shortly coming up on the show, we have the Usk Snow Report live from the chairlift at the Cadrona Alpine Resort. But before then, we've got to get through a song. That song is Star AD by American band Faith No More. Puritia kia raka.
Over and over. the zoo. It's all over the world. Illusion, it's on the zoo. It's all over the world.
Kia ora, you are listening to the Wednesday R1 News here on Radio 1, Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi 91 FM. Coming up now, we have a very exciting edition of the Weekly Snow Report. Peter Barclay from USC is going to be reporting live from Cadrona Alpine Resort. Kia ora, Peter.
Yeah, good morning, Kaya. I'm just sitting on the chairlift at Cadrona Alpine Resort, and golly, it is a beautiful day on the mountain. Blue skies, lovely snow, and yeah, I'm going to have a great day. We've got a little bit of crust on the snow, just at lower levels, so it got a little bit warmer down here, but up the mountain the snow should be nice and fresh and fluffy, which is really lovely. The rest of the week looks amazing. We've got a little bit of cloud, lots of sun going into Friday, and then the weekend looks good, a little bit cloudier, but still good. Got a huge dumping of snow on Sunday night, so this whole week is going to be great for the snow. Yeah, and that's about it. It's going to be a great week for skiing, and you guys should all get out there.
Kia ora, Peter. Thank you for that. And like he said, if you're listening and you're a keen skier, you should get out there. If you need a way to get up the mountain, the Otago University Snow Sports Club is the way to go. Join through OUSA's website. The time's 11:15, and coming up, Zach will be interviewing Professor Peter McIntyre from the University of Otago's Department of Women and Children's Health, about the polio outbreak in New York. But first, here is Asta Rangu with Tu Zuma here on R1 News.
Thank you.
This is the R1 News on Radio 1 91 FM. Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
Kia ora koutou, the time is 11:23 and you just heard my dad's favourite song, I Need My Girl by The National.
When you hear a story about a new disease outbreak, polio is probably the last thing that comes to mind. Polio has largely been eradicated across the world since 1999 in what was one of the most effective long-term vaccine programs in human history. Despite our success in eradicating polio, it does occasionally reappear. On July the 21st, an unvaccinated man in New York contracted the virus, marking this the first US case of the debilitating virus since 2013. This case has created headlines around the world and has prompted the Center for Disease Control to send a team to New York to determine how severe the situation is and investigate the case. just how severe is this polio case? Joining me now to discuss this recent polio scare is Professor Peter McIntyre from the University's Department of Women's and Children's Health. Kia ora, Peter. How's it going?
You're all right,
sir. Bill Gates recently warned that this polio case is a threat to us all on Twitter. How would you characterise the severity of this case?
Well, it's really only an issue for the very small number of people who haven't been vaccinated against polio. I mean, what's happened with this case is that it's a polio virus, which is a kind of mutated version of the one in the oral polio vaccine, because the oral polio vaccine, which used to be used in New Zealand up until about 2005, so around 20 years ago, it contains an actual live polio virus, which has been weakened, which you know, some people might remember their children being, or babies being given it as drops. And that vaccine was very effective, but one of the problems is that very rarely, the actual virus can mutate to a strain of the virus which can cause polio. And as a result, you can get paralysis, one in maybe a million doses or so. But because there wasn't any polio in New Zealand, the decision was made that even that very small risk was too much. And so New Zealand and most other, high-income countries went over to the injected vaccine, which doesn't have any risk of that, of the virus in the vaccine changing. But what seems to have happened in New York is that presumably a baby or a young child who'd received the vaccine, the oral vaccine overseas, has passed that vaccine virus out in stools. It's gone into the system. It's potentially circulated around the place without anyone knowing about it, which basically isn't a problem because, it doesn't really do anything if you are already immune to polio. But the problem turned up in New York because there was this county with very low immunization rates, and so someone who wasn't immunized came in contact with this virus from the oral vaccine and got sick. So it's a concern, but it's not a concern for people who are immunized.
Yeah, like you said, the virus, it's been found in wastewater around multiple counties in New York, which prompted the State Health Commissioner to warn that there may be hundreds of New Yorkers infected with the virus. Just how fast could polio spread in a high urban density environment like New York? And what kind of protection can, herd immunity offer those New Yorkers?
Well, herd immunity you talk about in different ways, I suppose, but it really comes down to, are you immunized or not? And the thing is that, in a big city like New York, the thing about it is that there are good sanitation systems in place. We've got sewage systems. There's good access to water for hand washing. And so it's all the usual things that you would do just as part of good hygiene, which is not too hard to maintain somewhere like New York or obviously in New Zealand. And ironically, one of the things that happened with polio was that, it's obviously been around for a long time, and it was in, wealthier countries which had really, good sanitation systems that polio started to turn up as a problem, in the 1920s, 30s, some of the biggest outbreaks from the 1950s. And that was actually because good sanitation meant that people weren't getting infected with polio as young children. They were getting infected as teenagers or adults, when the chances of getting paralysis, if you did get the polio virus, the wild one, not the vaccine one, were much higher if you were older when you first encountered it. So, in countries where sanitation wasn't nearly so good, most people got it as children. And some of them did get paralysis, but it was much less likely to happen than it was in adults. So it was an example of where improved sanitation and improved health caused polio to become much more in your face in places like the US, which is where the vaccine was first developed in the 1950s. And so we've sort of got used to not thinking about polio because it just hasn't been around in the Western Pacific in general for 20, 30 years. So this is a sort of wake-up call to say, well, you know, the virus could still turn up, most likely, from the vaccine. And it's not something to be concerned about if you're vaccinated, but we've seen this happen in other countries like the Netherlands as well, where they've got little pockets, you know, in the country where there are people, you know, often for religious reasons, who haven't got any vaccines. And those people, unfortunately, are still susceptible to getting polio if it turns up.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. What kind of response measures do you think that the New York Health Department and the Center for Disease Control can use to prevent the spread of polio in, you know, communities that do not have, particularly high immunization rates? What would you say would be the what kind of techniques can they use? Would quarantining be a bit overkill?
Yeah, well, I don't think they'd be able to do that even if they wanted to. You know, to be honest. You know, it sounds like in some of these counties in New York, unfortunately, the percentage of 2-year-olds who've had all their doses is down at, 60% or something. And that's why they've got this kind of gap, I suppose, a chink in the armor, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that the CDC and the public health people in New York will be working very hard to close that gap. And I guess it will refocus attention on this issue of, could you have circulating, vaccine virus in other places? And I think it's also been detected in London. It's previously been detected at Israel. And that's the reason why the WHO recommended some years ago that actually we move to a situation where even in, low-income countries, the first dose is an injection and then you get the oral dose later to try and avoid this problem turning up. But we're still in that final stage of trying to say, can we actually get rid of polio altogether, just like we got rid of smallpox? There are still a few pockets around the world where polio is still circulating, the original polio. And then there's a number of other pockets where the problem of the vaccine virus potentially causing polio exists when you've got low immunization rates. And we've seen this in the Philippines. We've seen it in New Guinea in the last few years. So it's not just places like Afghanistan and Africa. It can be closer to home. But the answer to all those problems in all those places is just getting the immunization rates up as high as we possibly can.
Mm. Seems like a good strategy to get rid of the virus. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, kia ora, Peter, for joining us this morning.
Okay, thanks, Zach.
Take care. Bye. That was Peter McIntyre from University of Otago's Department of Women and Children's Health speaking on the risks of the new polio outbreak and the importance of getting immunised against polio. Coming up on the program after this, we have an interview about the new data and statistics bill, which passed its third reading. So that'll be very, very exciting. It's 11:32 here on the program. Up now is Orville Peck with Dead of Night.
Night. You're right by my side. You wake me up. You say it's time to ride. In the dead of night, strange canyon road, strange look in your eyes. You shut them as we fly. As we fly. Go fast, I say, hold on tight.
We want to hear your thoughts. Text in to 0212 Radio 1.
Kia ora koutou katoa, you're listening to the Rapa R1 News Show here on Radio 1, Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. It is currently 11:39 a.m. and just before we had Professor Peter McIntyre from the University of Otago's Department of Women and Children's Health speaking on the recent polio outbreak in New York and the severity of it and what we can do about polio.
The Statistics Act of 1975 has governed how Aotearoa collects and uses data for the past few decades. However, our modern use of computers and new forms of data collection have potentially left the bill behind. A new bill was introduced to Parliament late last year, one which would alter how we interact with our data collection nationally. Last week, the new Data and Statistics Bill passed its third reading, so today we have Research Associate Professor Gabrielle Davey in to explain why this new bill has been introduced and what it could mean for the way we collect data. Kia ora, Gabrielle.
Kia ora.
In 1975, a law passed in Aotearoa enabling national data collection from individuals. This data, including information about race, age and finances, has been used in conjunction with the development of computers and evolved data collection methods to guide policy, influence public services and even predict how people might behave in the future. Do you think the way we use and collect data modernly is competently managed within the Statistics Act of 1975?
I can't comment. I haven't been following the details of the Statistics Act, but I did... I do realise that it needed to be updated. In terms of whether statistics are managed competently, I do think that Stats NZ is doing a great job of balancing the needs and the desires of researchers, including government, but also balancing the feedback from individuals and interested groups and affected parties such, yeah.
What sort of interaction have you had with the data collection bill and other forms of data collection as a researcher?
I haven't had any direct interaction in terms of the bill. I've more been, I'm more of a user of the data and the, in particular, the integrated data infrastructure that Stats New Zealand have set up that enables researchers to analyse administrative data while also protecting the rights of individuals in terms of having data de-identified.
Is there anything you've seen on that IDI base that you feel is is something that shouldn't be available to the public, or is there anything that you would like to see available to the public?
I think the IDI, so for the integrated data infrastructure, does contain a lot of information in terms of what should or shouldn't be available. I mean, I guess it's not, it's available in a sense to the public, but yet there are many levels of getting access to the data, and so many levels of making it safe for, in terms of, you know, you need particular project approval, you need approval for, they need to be safe researchers, you need to be in a safe space, and even the output has to be confidentialized in such a way. So it's not really available to the general public.
Craig Jones from Stats NZ described that the new bill intended to keep the legislation up to play with modern practices. Can you explain some of the changes this new bill will usher in, to the best of your knowledge, and how these align with, as Joan describes, modern practices?
Oh, not really. I'm not particularly skilled up to answer that question, sorry.
No worries, that's no problem. Do you have any idea what data will potentially be collected that doesn't fit in the remit for the use of official statistics, as is the change that the bill's bringing in?
I think there were some issues that this, I mean, obviously things have changed hugely in the way that data is collected, even in the last 5 years, let alone since sort of 1975. And I think that the bill from even the concept of being able to probabilistically link data between government agencies was something that was not on the radar back in 1975. And that is something that the government and, you know, and researchers is keen to have happen, because we can answer so many more questions with data that's been linked across sort of government agencies, bearing, you know, linked but then de-identified and analysed in a way that we can make determine research findings for groups of people, or sort of, you know, what the average result might be, rather than specifically for individuals.
And can you talk about some of these positive projects that have come out of the ability to access this large-scale data anonymously?
Yeah, there have been quite a range of projects, some led by government, a number led by universities and private research organisations. A couple of projects that I've been involved in. One, we were looking at the impact of injury on older adults and just looking at what effect that had on them going forward, sort of over the next couple of, the sort of 2 to 3 years. And I think we're really fortunate in New Zealand to have a system like, a scheme like ACC. But our research showed that even with ACC, older adults had reduced total income, even 3 years on from their injury. So just being able to find out things like that, where we've been able to utilise the ACC database, but also the IRD's income records as well, and to be able to analyse those at the same time.
Ngā mihi, Gabriel. Thank you for talking to us.
No problem.
Kia ora koutou. That was Gabriel Davey from the University of Otago. Up next, on the speaking on the Data and Statistics Bill, which has passed its third reading. It's currently 11:45 here on the R1 News. Coming up on the program, we have an interview with Chris Hepburn from the university, speaking about the Leith flooding and the environmental impacts that entails. But firstly, we got a song to get through. Here's 30th Century Man by Scott Walker.
And see the giants, which one would you choose to be? And if you can't get that together, here's the answer, here's the key. You can freeze like a 30th century man, like a 30th century man. I'll save my breath and take it with me till 100 years or so.
shame you won't be there to see me shaking hands with Charles de Gaulle. Play it cool and saran wrap all you can. Be a 30-century man. You can freeze like a 30-century man. Like a 30-century man.
Kia ora koutou katoa. It is currently 11:47 on the Rapa R1 News program. Just before we had Gabriel Davey, Associate Research Professor Gabriel Davey, speaking on the new Data and Statistics Bill, which passed its third reading quite recently.
Most will be familiar with the Leith flooding event, which occurred in Otipoti 2 weeks ago. The river, which runs directly through the university campus, flooded to the extent where its banks were at risk of bursting, resulting in the evacuation of 36 nearby properties. While many students had to flee their flats for the night, others took advantage of the flow, with the university's canoe and kayak club paddling the river and one student even attempting to surf what was estimated to be a grade 4 rapid. While the flood left plenty of visible debris in its wake, such as picnic tables and shopping trolleys, there will also be an environmental aspect to the aftermath of the flooding event. Here's Professor Chris Hepburn, a professor of the University of Otago's Marine Science Department, discussing how the way we treat our Leith might affect the environment, especially after mass floods like this.
Kia ora, how are you doing?
Not too bad. How are you?
Good, thank you. How do these sorts of floods around the Southland and Otago region impact our surrounding coastal environments?
Well, floods are natural events and they've been occurring forever. But more recently, with our adjustments or modification of catchment from headwaters, wetlands, right through to perhaps some of our rivers that go through urban environments, it really alters how floods occur. I'm not an expert in terrestrial and freshwater systems or hydrology, but as a marine scientist, these larger events, probably more sudden, more extreme, have really quite profound impacts on coastal ecosystems. So I'll go on and on, but back in the past, when we had intact wetlands and forested catchments, they would slow the flow of water, and now we get quite sudden events and they release sediment in particular, and then that damages our coastal environments. One, by reducing light penetration into coastal environments and also smothering rocky reef ecosystems.
And so that sediment coming down off the land occurs in these floods like this, where it's carrying more out to the coastal environments than it would usually be set up to manage?
Yeah, that's right. That's been happening probably for the last 100 years as we've cleared land. Today we are reforesting in some areas, and that could be fixing some of these issues. But we have really profoundly modified our coastal environments due to these sediment loads. Sediment and mud and things like that should be on the land have simply been released. In Otago, it's a real issue with catchments like the Clutha and Tairi, and also smaller catchments like the Waikawaiti or Waihemo Shag River. They release the sediment, and it's really reduced, the productivity of our coastal ecosystems, the habitat that's provided, and also impacting on fisheries and those values that we provide. So what we do on the land and how we change and modify has a really profound impact on our coastal environment as well.
The Leith is home to a range of creatures, including salmon, eels, brown trout and freshwater crays. How will these habitants cope with the recent flooding of the Leith?
Well, again, I'll just mention that I'm not a freshwater scientist or an expert in how streams operate. The Leith is a bit of an unusual beast, that its catchment is mainly forested, and then it has a very altered lower reaches. It flows through the university, and you see all those concrete walls and things, which have been modified recently, so just to make it a bit more natural. So generally, trout will be fairly okay. They're quite sensitive to many sort of pollutants and things like that. Coda, the freshwater crayfish, some could be lost. salmon, we don't really have them around anymore. I was actually having a bit of a look the other day. Salmon don't tend to run anymore up the river. They've never lived in here. They've always been released, so it's more their spawning habitat. So it'll be a shock. They'll recover eventually, but the Leith is a little bit different to, say, some of those bigger catchments that have had profound modification of their headwaters. So sediment loading coming down that river, I'm not sure it's as bigger impact as you'll see in something like the Tidy or those other bigger rivers.
And that sediment that does eventually end up in the ocean, how will those ocean environments respond to the sediment increase?
Well, Otago Harbour has been profoundly modified by the presence of Dunedin. The inner parts of the harbour have a lot of fine sediments, muddy systems. Probably the old reefs that used to be there have been covered. There's been a lot of land reclamation south Dunedin, and a lot of other areas in Dunedin were once estuaries, which provided a receiving environment for a lot of the sediment. So we'll go into the harbour, add to the issue. The inner harbour does have some values, though. There are some nice reef systems. I'm not a soft sediment person like mud ecosystems, but there are some nice reef systems. So any more sediment that you put in there will damage any remaining reef ecosystems, and also more sensitive soft sediment species like things like cockles and things like that that require a certain, you know, grain size of sediment.
And it's not only that sediment that's being carried in excess out to the ocean after these floods, it's also runoff from the streets, and especially in Dunedin, our environment around the streets isn't always the cleanest. How will the ocean environment respond to receiving such a bulk load of unnatural suburban runoff?
Well, the other thing too is that and nutrients. So nutrients can pollute, cause eutrophication, and then shift ecosystems into anoxic, low oxygen environments. Things like oil or things that have been on roads, different sorts of, I guess, pesticides and things like that can be absorbed by marine organisms, making them, I wouldn't eat anything probably. It's a filter feeder in the harbour. Mm-hmm. Certainly anything in the harbour after rainfall, any rainfall events, so you'll be having things like coliforms, fecal contaminants, viruses, all sorts of different things going into that creek. So that will have that impact, but a lot of those, the inner harbour's profoundly modified now. So we're at the bottom of the barrel, so we can't dig too much deeper. So I think impact-wise on the actual ecosystem, probably minor, because those impacts have already occurred, if you know what I mean. Yeah,
and you've mentioned, I know you're not a freshwater scientist, yeah, but can you talk at all about how the flooding around Aotearoa is projected to change over the coming years and how that's going to impact the ocean?
Not too much. All I've heard is that we'll be having more extreme events. So we'll be having more, you know, on the North Otago coast, I heard we got 90 mils overnight. After about 2 weeks of rain. So there's more extreme events. Change is obviously is coming. It seems like I'm pretty sure that our last month was the wettest on record, maybe for 65 years. We're going to start seeing unusual events, extreme events. But yeah, as I say, I'm more of a underwater sort of guy, and counting things, measuring things underwater.
No worries. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
No worries.
That was a cheeky little interview that Kai conducted with Professor Chris Hepburn from the University of Otago's Department of Marine Science. Bit of a word jumble there. What do we have on the program now, Kaya?
We have the astrology report.
Woo! Radio 1 Astrology. Bow chicken wow wow indeed. Welcome. Oh, sorry. Kia ora folks, haere mai and welcome to the Radio 1 Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi Astrology Report, a radio segment where we give the spiciest MF astrology takes.
We don't take prisoners!
Today we're shaking down all you Leos and Pisces, old school style. Alright, today is a day for admin, dear Leo. With the Capricorn moon pursuing up to dear Pluto, you can finally hoon all that yucky uni work and give the whare a fat clean-up. After all that mahi, I bet you're fiending a time to relax. Well, fret not, Leo. As sweet Luna connects to Aquarius, you'll have some time to take to, you know, some time to chill like a MF. The day isn't all daisies and nasturtiums, though, for you, Leo. As a T-square between the blazing sun and nodes of fate may instill some existential dread about your future prospects. You may ask yourself,
will I become a lawyer like dear old dad? Do my friends really like me? Do I have enough clout to be a Dunedin micro-celebrity?
Bro, just chill. Get some sleep and you'll forget about it all tomorrow. Hopefully.
Luckily for you, Pisces, the day is much less dread-inducing, although it isn't without its foibles. Today, your friendships will be put to the test. As old mate Capricorn Moon snuggles up to darling Pluto, this pairing will shine a light on who is and isn't loyal to you, Pisces. It's time to take out the trash.
Yeah, dump him!
Later on in the Arvo, you'll feel a little bit introspective, but ultimately, you'll come to the conclusion that introspection isn't girl boss slay. Chuck on some Taylor Swift. And plot the demise of the powers that be.
And that has been your Radio 1 Astrology Report for the R1 News on Rapa, Te Tiko or Here Turi Koka. And I think that just about wraps up our show, doesn't it, Kaya?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. It's been a pretty busy little show. We've had the Usk Weekly Snow Report from Peter Barclay, live from Cadrona, which is very impressive. And then what do we have after that?
We had the polio examination of the new outbreak of polio in New York. Zach spoke to Professor Peter McIntyre from the University of Otago's Department of Women and Children's Health.
Yeah, it was pretty bonkers. After that, we had a little data interview with Gabrielle Davey from the University of Otago, where she speaks about the new data and statistics bill and all the implications of that.
And we tied it all up with examination of the environmental and unseen consequences of the Leith flooding and other flooding events in Aotearoa. And then, of course, you just heard
the astrology report.
The astrology
report. For Leo and Pisces. Report. You're listening to the R1 News. Be sure to listen to R1 News every weekday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. Have a fantastic day and try not to go too crazy this week. Be sure to get some plenty of rest, I would advise. Up next is Black Midi with Love Story, the Taylor Swift cover. You're listening to Radio 1.
You've been tuned in to the R1 News. Weekdays from 11 to 12 here on Radio 1 91 FM. Te reo irirangi kotahi. Catch up at r1.co.nz/news. Or find us at Radio 1 91 FM on Twitter or R1 News NZ on Instagram.
Thank you for listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. There's heaps more at r1.co.nz.